Hello and welcome back to another edition of Coffee Talk on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. My name is Trevor Huth. I am joined, as always, by Mr. Nate Kosher. Nate, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm excited for the episode tonight.
Yeah, so am I at Coffee Talk. We're always ready for that next cup of coffee, but tonight we actually have something really awesome. We've been talking about it for a little bit. A few episodes ago, we were talking about the switch pitcher at Mississippi State, Durangelo Cinche, and that led to the conversation of MLB's, I believe, still only switch pitcher. So we happen to have him, Mr. Pat Vendetti. Pat, thank you so much for being on with us.
Yeah, excited to be on, fellas.
Yeah, so first of all, I can't imagine how difficult it was to learn how to throw from both sides, Pat. Was that a hard process for you?
I started young enough to where it was difficult, but not as hard as it would be if, you know, you try to do something as an adult. I tried to swing a golf club the other day left-handed, and it like felt like I'd never swung a golf club before. So it's one of those things that if you start it young enough, you can teach it to some degree, but there's just something about, for me at least, God-given right-handed is my ability, and that's just how it is. And I know there's people out there that can do things both hands, but without a lot of practice, that's not me. Like, I can't shoot baskets left-handed. I can't golf, bowling, none of it.
But you can pitch left-handed. So, I mean, that's what you needed.
There was a lot of sliders I practiced over the years to make that happen at a lot of different arm angles. But, it was one of those things where, growing up, it felt somewhat natural, if that makes sense, but I could always tell that the right was just a little easier. It was just, things just came easier right-handed. And then when I dropped down sidearm left-handed my sophomore year of college at Creighton, it just clicked for me left-handed. It went from being something that was really difficult to do, and I don't want to say it was easy, but it felt much more comfortable. And that was what I did for the next 15 years after that, too, is just that sidearm delivery. And fortunately, I had a coach tell me to try something one day, and I'm glad I did.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That was one of the questions I was actually going to ask. Were coaches for it or against it? And, you know, what was the advice that they gave you?
The higher you get, the coaches are tied to your wins and losses. So their open-mindedness was, how was I going to help them win? If that makes sense. So I would say the majority of them were open to it, but they needed to see it and they needed to make sure that was going to be the most efficient way for me to help that ball club. And it would take an outing or two, but once I think they saw how I competed and how I went about things left on left and right on right, not only were they for it, I think they kind of realized that because of my stuff that was not even close to off the charts, it was the matchup that I needed. So I needed to be able to pitch lefty against lefties, have that slider starting at the, you know, at the hip, going away from them, and the same thing right-handed. Mm-hmm. I just didn't have anything in my repertoire to get that off-sided hitter out on a consistent basis. So they realized, I think, it was kind of a necessity.
So I do want to dig more into what it's like being able to pitch left-handed, right-handed, but ever since you debuted and we were able to see the glove you had to wear, I just have one question. Is that comfortable? It seems like it'd be so big and clunky on your hand.
You know what? It's the only thing I've known since I was 7. So regular gloves feel super awkward on my hand. But anybody else that puts it on, they call it like a floppy alien. Like it's a big thing that just opens up. But it's one of those things to where it's what I know. Baseball was always played for me with that glove on. So now I have a couple, you know, right-handed only gloves that I'll play catch outside with my son. And it's not quite the same.
Are you missing balls, or does it just feel weird?
it's not that bad, but it's definitely an awkward feeling. I definitely prefer the bigger web and the floppiness of the glove that I've known my whole life.
Right. So is it, I mean, what was the mindset like having to switch from one hand to another hand mid game?
That's very difficult. The hardest thing would be when there was, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 hitters stacked in a row, and where you'd have a longer inning. So it's been maybe 5 or 6 minutes since you've thrown a pitch with that other hand. and it was usually left-handed because there was never like six lefties stacked, but it was commonplace to see five righties in a row, six righties. And then the next thing you know, it's been a few minutes and now you got runners on second and third with two outs and you need to locate a nasty off-speed pitch right off the bat. And that was one of those things that took a lot of practice, and I never fully mastered it. I mean, if you look, you know, there would be outings where I would hit guys, walk guys, especially after those switches. So no matter how much I focused on it on the off season and did all the things, it was just something that was very, very difficult to do.
So if you had advice for this college kid from Mississippi State, and if he wants to continue being a switch pitcher, if you could talk to him, what would you tell him? And I guess I should ask, have you seen him or watched any of the highlights?
Yeah, he's incredible. I mean, he's 98 right-handed, dominating the SEC. I haven't seen as much left-handed, but just stuff-wise, it looks incredible. And he looks like a top-round draft pick to me. I don't know how things shake out anymore. It's been, I think, 15 years since I was drafted, and I'm looking at some of these radar gun numbers and just like, thank God I'm not in high school or college today. I would have had no chance. but just, you know, I think that more than anything is to just, you know, stick with it. If that's his path, he may have a path as a righty, you know, one day pitching right-handed, one day pitching left-handed. He has the stuff where it seems he doesn't really need that matchup advantage. So you can really do anything with it. And I mean, anytime you have that type of upside, you know, they have years to figure out how they're going to use him.
Yeah, I think he's 92 on his left side even. So
it's incredible.
As you said, upper 90s on the right side. So, I mean, that could get him there maybe just using that.
If I was throwing 98 right-handed, I don't think I would have ever touched a ball left-handed once I left college.
Right. Exactly.
So just speaking of training up both sides, what does that look like, you know, typically in a practice? If you're trying to do long toss or throwing bullpens, do you have a lefty day and a righty day, or do you have to just switch every throw? I mean, what does that look like?
Basically, I treat it as that I was two separate players that needed to be ready in the same day. So I would rarely have days where I would just play catch with one hand. I would try to mimic whatever I was doing one side with the other side. So in pro ball, I would go out with the starter, or like the starting pitchers that go out at 2:30 to throw their bullpens before the relievers. I would go out with that group of starters, long toss, one arm, do the whole stretch warm-up routine that way, come in, spin my stuff, you know, work on changeups in the flat ground, go inside for 20 minutes, and then I would just be a typical reliever from whatever the other side was. I would join the reliever stretch, do all of that again from the other side. So it was kind of double the training to be that two-in-one pitcher once the game started.
So, yeah, I mean, that I can't even imagine. I mean, that's what I'm listening to you, and it's just blowing my mind, all the stuff that you had to go through.
You know, mental part of the game, even more than the physical, I would imagine, just throwing the ball, like to kind of switch what you're doing every day, it seems difficult.
Surprisingly, that part is just kind of natural. Okay. Where you get to the point throwing a baseball where you don't think about anything. It's just it's a memorized motion. It's muscle memory, if you will, and that kind of takes over. Now, on the days when you've hit a couple guys, you're walking somebody, giving up a double, yeah, then the mental games can come in, and you got to figure out and have kind of a set routine. Okay, get yourself back in here. What are you going to do? And then you start to think about it a little bit more. But for me, it was just a few little mental cues, balance, direction, finish. Those were kind of my checkpoints, and I would just go off of that. There wasn't too much thoughts during the game about switching, but that's just how it was.
Well, and it seems like it's such – you're the only one, right? So was that difficult to, I mean, receive coaching for? Is that just regular pitching coaching just from both sides? It's just such a different look, I think, than anything else that would have been coming through a system.
It was. And, you know, the first system I was with the Yankees, I was there 7 years. So they got to know me inside and out. I got to know all those coaches. It was very familiar. And then, like, first day of spring training with the A's, which was my first team after I left New York, you know, they had no idea what to do. And they just kind of left it in my court. And by the time you get to a major league camp, there's nobody sitting there telling you what your day is going to look like. It's completely up to you to be ready to go when you pitch. And there's coaches there that are just there to help you do what you want to do. So, you know, I would grab a bullpen catcher or one of the pitching coaches from the minor leagues. We'd go out early in the morning during spring training before the game started, would do that same type of thing that I would do with the starters, but just with the coach. And then they would just treat the bullpen sessions like I was any other pitcher and, you know, coach accordingly.
Mm-hmm. And what about like grips and stuff? I mean, were you looking to throw the same pitches both sides? Did you have the same grips? Did you have a different grip for the same pitch on either side?
There is not a part of a baseball I haven't tried to throw a pitch from. I tried every grip under the sun. Anything anybody would tell me, I would try it and see how it worked. There was a couple off seasons where I tried to come back throwing a knuckleball when I was like 28. It didn't work. Never took it into a game. But I would throw a slider, a changeup, and a fastball over the top and sidearm right-handed. Left-handed, I was pretty much just sidearm, slider, fastball. Grips were pretty much the same until, what was it? I think 2016, Jesse Chavez, who's still pitching with the Braves and doing really well. I was struggling with my slider and he had this, you know, this grip where instead of taking it off my middle finger and spinning, he wanted me to straddle the seams and then throw the slider off of my index finger. And I went from having probably below average slider right-handed to something that was a little bit more effective and bought me several more seasons of pitching, you know, at Triple A and the major league level. So each side had some different grips and different nuances, and it really would change kind of week to week, you know, depending on, you know, what the body was doing. Cause throughout a season you have certain movements that just can't get there because maybe you're a little tight or something happens where, because you've been throwing the ball pretty much every day for 7 months, you got to figure out a way to make some adjustments. So it was just constantly evolving.
That was something else I was wondering about. Was there ever an injury that then forced you to go solo, either right arm or left arm, so you could keep pitching?
So in 2012, in spring training, I tore my labrum on my right side, and I tried to rehab it to no avail. So I ended up having surgery in June. I wasn't able to come back and do anything in the rest of 12, but then I was getting ready for the World Baseball Classic that following spring 2013, pitching for Team Italy, and, you know, being 7 months out of surgery, there was no chance I was going to pitch right-handed. Yeah. But I did all of the things to be ready left-handed, and I pitched in that first classic strictly left-handed. But then I didn't get back to affiliated ball with the Yankees until I was fully recovered both ways. They didn't really have much interest at the time in me just pitching left-handed. I needed that matchup advantage. So sure. For the classic, I did just pitch left-handed, but after that it was back to rehab and waiting till I was full strength from both sides. But kids would ask me every day, like, why can't you go pitch? And
yeah,
well, they're still like pointing and pulling and there's all these things that go
into it. That easy.
Still, yeah, it's just, it doesn't really work like that. Now, maybe if it was Tommy John or something else, I could have maybe done a little bit more of that, but for the shoulder, it was just, I needed both.
Well, knowing you were only lefty, did you invest in a lefty glove and use that, or did you still use the ambidextrous glove?
No, that, like I said, that would have been a weird endeavor trying to field a ball with a one-handed glove. I don't think I've ever entered a game and fielded a ball without anything but that two-handed mitt.
So you said you've been using that two-handed mitt since you were seven?
That style, yeah. So Mizuno sent me my first one when I was seven. I don't know if I have one above me. I actually have the most useless thing of all time right here. This is a two-handed first baseman's mitt made by Mizuno.
Wow.
I had one of these made so I could shag both hands, but I don't have one of my other ones here. But yeah, I've had one of those since I was seven.
Have they always made those, or did you have to special request it at that time?
The master craftsmen there have done that before I was born, to my knowledge. So I got my first one in 1992 when I was seven, and my last one would have been 2021 was the last one I had made.
Hmm. That's crazy. I would have thought that's something, yeah, you had to special order.
Incredible. Well, I definitely had to special order it, and they don't make it. They don't sell it at all. Even when people will request it. It's, I think it's just kind of a hassle for them because it comes from one of their factories. I believe in Osaka was the factory I was getting mine from when I was younger. And I remember my dad traced my hand when I was six, faxed it to Mizuno. And then when I was seven, a glove showed up from, he came home from a work trip in San Francisco. He apparently met the Mizuno rep who had just gotten it from Japan and brought it home to me. And that was how I got my first glove.
That is awesome.
Yeah. I have a sweet spot for those gloves. That's for sure.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
So you mentioned a son. Does he show interest in baseball? And then what strategy are you using with him? Which arm is he using?
He is strictly right-handed. He loves baseball. My dad was always a baseball guy. He was always played in college, still plays today. He's 79 years old, and he goes down to Florida every spring and fall to play in the over, I think, 65 tournament, then the over 75 in that Roy Hobbs Baseball League. Wow. So he's a baseball fanatic. And just he had the idea to do something a little bit different. My thought process is, though, I think I'll be able to train my son in a way that, you know, my dad just didn't know how to train physically and, you know, from a weight training perspective, from a throwing program perspective, and then most importantly, from a delivery perspective. He's seven. He can't really catch. He's got a great looking delivery. He's got a great balance, a good finish. So we'll get the rest of it. And so much of, you know, is tied to genetics too. I think so much of how hard you throw, some of it's tied to how you train, but at the end of the day, some people are just wired to throw harder than others. So if he does have a path in baseball, it'll be just as a righty.
Thank you for saying that. I never threw harder than 72 miles an hour, and now I can blame my dad. So I really appreciate you saying that.
I mean, I long tossed since I was 15 years old. Like, I would do all the things that, you know, I would do the shoulder care, the bands, and all of that since I was 15. And I mean, I guess when I was with the Yankees, I was probably 84 to 85 left-handed. But towards the end of my career, even with Miami in 2020, I was throwing 79 mile an hour fastballs. Like, it wasn't in there left-handed, and right-handed, I maybe touch 91 every now and again, even with all that training. Now, I didn't do all of the things that I did when I was 32, when I was 15, 16, during those formative years, that I'm sure plays a role in that too. But as your body's developing, if you're doing, you know, some other things strength wise and agility wise and quickness wise, I think that I could have had some more in there. It was just too late by the time I was figuring out all this stuff.
Yeah, for sure. So we're not going to hold you too long, Pat. Again, we really, really appreciate your time. We need to ask the typical, we have a former pro baseball player on our podcast questions. Do you have like a favorite moment from your career that you could share with us?
Absolutely. The one that stands out the most was the night I got called up was 2015. After over 7 years in the minor leagues, I was in Nashville, got called in after the game, was told I was going to join the big league club the next day in Fenway. We had a series against Boston. So my wife was with me at the time. We went outside. I was able to tell her, and then I called my dad right away. Just being able to call him and tell him that was one of the best moments of my career. And then the next night I was pitching in Fenway. I got to throw two innings in front of my family. My wife's family was there. And a couple friends were able to get there as well. But just having that journey where there was so many unknowns and not really knowing for sure if I would ever get that opportunity to finally have it. And then, you know, with switching back and forth in a big league game, I understood the importance of having that first one be a good one, because if you go there and it's bad, it's going to be really hard for those teams, you know, to give a whole bunch of chances to something that doesn't exist. Yeah. So that debut day, just because it was so long in the making, I was almost 30 years old, and just because it was a couple good innings there to start my career, I would probably say that was probably the best baseball moments of my life.
And is there a hitter or maybe a few hitters that stand out as like the toughest to face?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot.
I'm sure there are.
Trout was not fun. I didn't have much in the arsenal that he was afraid of. I tried everything, fastballs in, fastballs away, sliders, changeups. He was squaring it up. And if not, he was fouling it off until the next time he squared something up. And then the hitter I probably struggled with the most was Rougned Odor from the Rangers.
Oh, yes.
That left-on-left advantage that I had against most guys, it just did not exist against him. Same type of thing where I tried every pitch. And if I was getting him out, it was a loud out somewhere. It was, and I couldn't get out of the AL West either. So I was just constantly facing him from Seattle to Oakland. I just couldn't get away. And then Toronto, it lined up where we were playing him. And then I think we had interleague with him with the Dodgers. Like, it just lined up every year that I'd have to face my demons.
That's great.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Really appreciate your time, Pat. And thanks once again, you know, just kind of cold called on LinkedIn when I was like, I wonder if I can find this guy anywhere. And no, so really appreciate it.
I enjoy talking ball. It's fun to talk about these memories. And yeah, I got a good appreciation for people that enjoy the game and talk the game as well. So I'll do it anytime.
Pat, before you get off, is there anything that you want to plug or talk about?
No, I appreciate you guys having me on here. This has been awesome. Love promoting the game. It's in a great place right now. I do wish the pitch clock would have been around when I was going. I would have loved that because I was always getting slowed down by people. But at Creighton, we were always talking about pace of play and how important it is to keep the defense behind you engaged. And I love what I'm seeing right now. It's a fun product to watch right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The pitch clock was something. I mean, I scour minor leagues more than I watch Major League Baseball. I'm on MILB TV constantly. So I got to see it a year before everybody else. And like, it was fine. It was immediately fine. You got used to it really quick. And I agree. I think it's really good for the game.
And then you mix in those, you know, those pitchers that just have a little bit more command at the major league level. The game keeps moving along. Yeah. And it honestly speeds up the hitters a little bit too, because so much of the time things speed up for pitchers where, at least for me, where, you know, bad things are happening, just kind of snowballs. Mm-hmm. And then if the pitcher needs time, they just step out of the box, you know, pop their chain, walk around a couple times. But there's like added pressure now to where you have to think about something else other than just what's going to happen. It's a chess match, and it's fun to watch.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So anyway, Pat, thank you so much for being on. And we will have more of Coffee Talk coming up. It's just going to be Nate and I, but keep listening anyway. There's more Coffee Talk coming up where we are always ready for that next cup of coffee on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. And welcome back to Coffee Talk on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. My name is Trevor Huth. We have Nate Kosher with me as well. And we're going to talk more baseball now. But before we do, again, want to thank Pat Vendetti for coming on the podcast with us. That was a fantastic conversation. I learned quite a bit. And I got a question since he debuted in 2015, I believe. I got a question about his glove answer that I've been wanting to know since then. So it's been a productive night, Nate.
Yeah, that's a bucket list item right there. You saw 10 years in the making.
Oh my gosh, I know. Oh man, that I probably could have asked. We could have gone for 10 minutes just about the glove, I'm sure. But we have other baseball to talk about, Nate.
We do. We do.
Particularly, he's not necessarily a Coffee Talk guy, but we have talked about him before. An anticipated debut, probably the most anticipated debut of the year, other than, I don't know, several others like Jackson Holliday, Jackson Churio, you know, all those guys.
Maybe the pitcher debut of the season, you could argue.
There you go, right? We're excited about that. Although when Jackson Jobe debuts, if he debuts, I'm going to think that's more exciting personally as a Tigers fan. But that's okay. Fair enough. You don't know by now, we're talking about Paul Skeens, who debuted for Pittsburgh. Almost didn't happen because it was rainy that day in Pittsburgh, which I don't know what would have happened. I think, I don't know. People would have gone crazy, but he did debut. Paul Skeens is a major league pitcher. Nate, how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I'm just glad it happened because, like you said, it's been so anticipated. And as baseball fans, we're like, when's it going to happen? When's it going to happen? And so it finally happened, right? And I think it was interesting. He had the heat, obviously. The velocity was there. 7 strikeouts, but not as, like, not even close to as dominant as a AAA level that he's been. So of course, there's probably some nerves. As you said, the weather, maybe, you know, that was in his head, but he went four innings, gave up six hits, three earned runs, and a home run and two walks. So what did you think about it, Trevor?
Well, it could have been nerves. It could have been the weather. It could also be that MLB hitters are really good.
Major leagues are hard. Yeah.
It's a different animal than Triple A. So yeah, it's very hard to come up and just be able to do that. So, you know, I wouldn't worry too much about it. He's got the nasty stuff. He's up for good. He showed signs of what makes him Paul Skeens. And I'll tell you what I think, honestly, about Paul Skeens and about Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, you have a guy who was arguably the top pitching prospect in baseball. Personally, I had him at number two. Many people had him at number one. And you have a guy who was a top 100 pitching prospect, top 100 prospect rather, to start the year, who has pitched brilliantly for you and is being compared, at least from what I've seen on Twitter, to Spencer Strider, which is a lofty comparison.
Yes.
The deliveries are not too dissimilar. I'm talking about Jared Jones. But you have Paul Skeens and Jared Jones now at the top of your Pittsburgh rotation for a while. And that I wouldn't want to be a hitter having to play Pittsburgh if we're going to see that part of the rotation.
Yeah, that's, I mean, if both those guys can stay healthy and continue, you know, their ascent, I mean, it's great for the Pirates, you know, probably one of the more, and I don't want to say forgotten teams, but they had their stretch, obviously, with Barry Bonds, you know, in early 90s, but they were bad for a long time. So it would be fun for the Pirates to be good. It's a great ballpark, you know, for them to be relevant. And I think a few episodes ago, I compared them to Tom Glavine and Greg Maddux, and I want to scratch that from the record. Since these guys throw so fast, I need to think of a new combination, but it's not those two. If you're,
he's giving me shades of Kyle Hendricks.
You made fun of me for that. So we're going to think of a new one.
Yeah, they throw hard. They throw triple digits, which is not what the players you're comparing to them through.
Just big names on the top. That's what I was trying to talk about. But yeah, I think, I mean, as far as you said, coffee talk, I wouldn't even think Skeens is available probably in any leagues. He's probably drafted in the beginning and people were just holding him. So I don't think, I mean, if he is available, I'd say yes, pick him up. I doubt he's available, but he's upper echelon, top prospect. You'd want to get him if you could.
That's true. You know what? Two guys who might be available, and I'm going way off script here, so Nate's going to have to figure it out in the moment. And I apologize ahead
of
time.
Go for it.
Two guys who might be available that just, like, today, day of recording, were brought back up. We've seen them before in Major League Baseball. Matt Manning and Bo Brisky both play for the Tigers. Matt Manning has been up already this year. He's thrown pretty well every single time he's come up. He was up... Well, the game he threw the day he came up, which would be today as we're recording it, yesterday, if you're listening to the day it posted, it's Monday. Went 5.2 innings, gave up nine hits, three earned runs, struck out five. So he's been having some pretty good performances. He's not setting the world on fire or anything. And Bo Brisky has had his moments over the last couple of years, too. So do either of those two interest you?
Actually, Bo Brisky in my... Dynasty League I play in, I had him for some time last year, actually, after he debuted. And if I recall, he was out of the bullpen. Is that right, last year, or was he a starter? I can't remember.
I know when he first came up, he was a starter. There have been so many injuries that have happened with the Tigers that I honestly can't remember what he did
well
last year.
Nonetheless, I remember having him. I do remember liking him. Mm-hmm. And I think Matt Manning's probably the more well-known name of the two, but
he was out of the bullpen a lot last year, 25 games, one start.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. But I liked him I remember having him on my team and good strikeouts and that does interest me. I would say Manning, a good like middle of the rotation guy, wouldn't you say?
Manning to me is back end. I mean, when they had the big three, the three headed monster of starting pitching prospects with Mize, Scooble, and Manning, Manning was always the bottom of the three for me. Well, I thought he had the highest ceiling, which is completely wrong because Tarek Skubal exists, and my bad, Tarek Skubal. But I thought he had a pretty high ceiling he could reach. I just it by the time he was in the upper minors, I thought it became clear that it was going to be really tough for him to reach that lofty ceiling he had. But you know, I think that he falls under the category of you can stream him when he has a good matchup.
Yeah, that's fair.
And maybe he could prove otherwise, because again, he's shown some signs this year. He really has, and he might pick it up. But as of right now, I think for me, he's still in that category of if he has the matchup, then it's worth it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, he's not the most exciting player out there, but with all the pitcher injuries and inconsistencies, it's someone who might be a perfect streamer.
Absolutely. And I just one more Tiger pitcher. I'm so sorry, but my favorite Tiger pitcher over the last prospect of theirs over the last few years, Reese Olson has been showing out, and I just need to talk about him on every platform that I can. Reese Olson guy, always have been. I am not even kidding you. There is a tweet out there, if you look up my Twitter handle, where I said the only two pitchers, I think it was from 2022 or something. I don't know. I don't even know, but you can look it up. And I said the only two pitchers in the Detroit Tigers system that I thought had front end potential was Jackson Jobe and Reese Olson. And I'm not saying he's reached that level at all. Don't get me wrong, but he is having a heck of a season so far. 2.52 ERA. You know, he's thrown 39 innings, 35 strikeouts. I mean, he's showing a lot of signs of improving and becoming really good. And I love Reese Olson, and I'm really happy that he's having a good year. At least start to the year.
He is looking good. I saw his numbers are great, although he doesn't have a win yet. Like he's had some.
He doesn't. He's 0-4, but he, you know.
Tough luck.
You know what they say about those pitcher wins. It's the most accurate stat of how somebody's playing. They don't say that. If your friend says no, that, they don't know they ball. Don't. Just.
2.52 ERA, though, and 1.11 whip. So, yeah, I mean, he's pitching well.
Yeah, he really is, and it's awesome to see. So another prospect that got called up, this guy might wind up being a Coffee Talk guy this year. I'm not really sure what his availability is in terms of redraft leagues, but that's Robert Gasser in Milwaukee. They traded for him. Robert Gasser was drafted by the Padres. So at one point, I'm sure I couldn't even tell you the deal, but he came over to Milwaukee, and that's really fun because
the Josh Hader, perhaps,
might have been actually, yeah. So Robert Gasser's a lefty. I know when he was with the Padres, I really liked his stuff. And then you go to a pitching lab like the Brewers, and that's only more exciting. Were you able to watch any of Robert Gasser's debut, Nate?
I did not, but even I have a friend who lives in the Milwaukee area. He doesn't know anything about baseball, and he even knew it was happening. So that tells me it was a big deal, and he was asking me about him, but I wasn't able to watch, unfortunately. I saw, the numbers were good, right? He did well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, you're looking at a lefty arm, and velo might be a key for him. I don't, you know, he's not running the ball by guys at triple digits like our friends Paul Skeens and Jared Jones. I think, you know, he's a lefty. He's low, maybe mid 90s in my experiences watching him. Love the slider. I think he's got a really good slider. And there's a lot to like there.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question becomes, what are your expectations that you put on Robert Gasser as to what he's going to do for, well, the Brewers obviously have their idea for their organization, but also for your fantasy team. And you know, I'm trying to talk and watch his sliders, videos of his sliders, which are absolutely insane, by the way. But
yeah. So Well, I'll jump in with a thought. I saw he was pretty efficient. So he only threw 79 pitches, and he went six innings, I believe. Yeah, mm-hmm. six scoreless innings. So if you're looking at the from a fantasy perspective, maybe not the big strikeout numbers that, or this, the gas that the other two guys, pun intended again, we were talking about. But if you can go farther into games, maybe you're looking at someone who can get some quality starts. And if they let him go that long in his first start, you know, he didn't throw that many pitches. Perhaps that's his benefit, or where he can make a difference.
Yeah. So that's kind of where I was headed, actually, Nate. He throws a lot of pitches, or he didn't throw a lot of pitches. He was very efficient. He's filling up the zone. He has a big slider. And so the question is, does he have the stuff that puts him into the middle or top of a rotation? And that's where that excitement, right? Yeah. You said your friend who doesn't even like baseball knows that Robert Gasser's debuting today. At what point is the excitement going to potentially overthrow how good he is? Now, he's a very good pitcher. Don't get me wrong. He threw really well. But if he winds up being a back-end starter who is just a lefty that throws in the low, maybe touches mid-90s, and he's filling up the zone with strikes, I mean, is that a guy who's going to ascend to a top of a rotation and be a guy like, man, I really need to go pick him up right now?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. That perhaps not. If he's not, I guess he could be someone that's middle of the, I guess kind of like we were talking with Matt Manning, maybe slightly better control, but I don't think, maybe another streamer, I guess. I'm kind of thinking through this as we're talking.
Well, and this comes with seeing him, by the way, right? Like you can look at the raw, you can look at the stuff. There's plenty of avenues to do that. But if you don't watch him pitch and how he uses the stuff, that question's never going to get answered.
Yeah.
And again, this is not me saying that he's not going to be any good in the major leagues. Obviously, he had a fantastic and electric debut, and he's got a ton of talent. I mean, I liked him as a prospect. But when you were talking fantasy, right, we talk all the time, a guy who might be better in real life than he is in fantasy. And I think that's just a fear I have for Robert Gasser in terms of if you're trying to win a fantasy league.
That's and fair. There,
that's the difference.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, I agree. I think he's going to be a meaningful player for the Brewers, but maybe I would put him on the let's monitor. If he has another good start, I would say maybe make a move just because of how we've talked about the pitching landscape. But yeah, I don't think the ceiling for him is as high as Skeens or some of these other Jared Jones or some of these other power pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the fantasy ceiling.
Right. Cause what do you, I mean, I don't win fantasy leagues, so take it with a grain of salt, but what do you look for in pitchers when you look in fantasy? First thing I look for is strikeouts. I'll be honest. That's the very first thing.
Say. Yeah.
Beyond anything else. Right. So if it's a pitcher who's not going to rack up a ton of strikeouts, generally I'm not that interested.
No, I mean, I think it depends if you were mentioning wins, if you play for wins, that's not, I don't know the percentage of people that do that, but then you're looking for people on good teams that would mm-hmm. get run support. You know, right. Not necessarily an indication of their talent necessarily, but just while they're on a good team.
Right, right. Like Jacob deGrom, when he was the best pitcher in the world, couldn't help you with wins because he played on the New York Mets.
Yeah, he won the Cy Young and went 7-9 or whatever it was.
Yeah, he had like a .001 ERA and six losses. So one thing I want to talk about before we hit our next break, Nate, really quick. It happened tonight, night of recording. Christopher Morel exited the Cubs game after fouling a ball off of his toe. And I guess it was pretty bad, maybe not in good shape, might not play the next couple of days. The question is, do you think that there's a move to be made? Like, do they bring up an Alexander Canario who, you know, might be a useful streamer if you want to, you know, try to jump after it if Morel's going to be out for a little bit? Or is that something that you're going to monitor for to see if you can get a guy for a couple weeks?
Yeah, actually, it's very coincidental you brought this up, because this morning I was looking through my prospect or my deep dynasty league, and I was looking through prospects and just who was available on the waiver wire, and just looking at who's interesting and who's, you know, might have some talent out there. And Canario, he had already been up to the majors, and he did all right. I mean, he didn't play that many games, 13 games, but I actually put a bid on him. I might have to increase that bid after this injury, but yeah, that's someone I am monitoring. I think he could be useful, powerful bat. He could DH, and it's weird that Morel got hurt, because I think if they're great, Morel's pretty versatile, but also another guy who go hot and cold and hit with power. Right. So,
Morel is streaky but electric.
If they're looking to replace his power, maybe Canario is the answer.
Nate, it's so funny. Alexander Canario. So I have, you know, my Twitter account has not a huge following, but it's more than, I guess, a lot of people have, right? I mean, in terms of people I interact with, right?
Sizable, yeah.
So I hate talking about it. I really do. That's why I probably sound very uncomfortable. But it's about, you know, I think it's a little over 4,000, which, again, not a whole lot. I don't have any of those followers, I don't think, without our friend Alexander Canario. I swear. It has nothing to do with my actual ability as a baseball analyst or a prospect analyst or anything. I try my hardest. But when Alexander Canario got traded from the Giants to the Cubs in the Chris Bryant trade a few years back,
okay,
he went on this torrid pace of home runs. I mean, he was hitting a home run a day forever, it seemed like. I mean, he was hitting home run after home run after home run, and I was clipping them all and tweeting them out. And I feel like that gained me 1,000 followers at least. Like, thank you, Alexander Canario. Okay, you have made my entire Twitter account.
If he does nothing else.
Right. I am admitting it has nothing to do with me and my abilities. It is all Alexander Canario hitting loads of home runs after getting traded from one system to another system. And it was kind of crazy because, if I remember correctly, the Cubs gave Canario an aggressive assignment and all he did was just hit tanks.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
It's a good strategy, right? The team wants to see if I can do it, so I'm just going to hit a bunch of home runs. Hey, that tells me you could do it.
Right. I was just reading a story about him here. It says he's listed at 165. This is quite the range, but it says he's closer to 215 pounds than his listed weight of 165. So yeah, that's a big difference.
Yeah. I'll take the over on 165 for sure.
But yeah, that's someone I would be watching because he's already had some success this season. I wouldn't be surprising if they call him up again.
Him being listed at 165 is kind of like when I asked the person who put my profile up online for my college baseball to make me 6 foot.
Or the weight you have on your driver's license, you know, that stays the same no matter how you age.
By the way, I was not put as 6 foot. Oh man. All right. Dude. We got more coffee talk coming up. While we dispute my height, I'm going to go, while we have the break playing, I'm going to go measure myself to see if I'm up to 6 foot yet. I doubt it. We'll see what happens. But we'll be right back with more Coffee Talk, where we are always ready for that next cup of coffee. And, of course, Coffee Talk is a part of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. And welcome back to Coffee Talk on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. My name is Trevor Huth. It turns out I am still 5'11"-ish. Not 6 foot, but I don't even know if I'm 5'11", so I might have just shrunk down to 5'10". Who knows? It doesn't matter. I'm joined by Nate Kosher. Nate, how you doing?
I'm good. I was just thinking about, I don't know if you saw this, if you follow the NBA at all, but LeBron James' son, Bronny James, today was the draft combine, and he measured at like 6'1" and some change, and he'd been listed at USC at 6'4". But it was a big story today because no shoes on. He's 6'1", and they said, "Oh, that's probably going to hurt him. But apparently he's going into the NBA draft and his name is LeBron James. So I think he'll probably end up somewhere just with the hope that his dad follows. And
well, if a team wants LeBron James, they're probably going to have Bronny James. Look at this turn into a basketball podcast.
It's just
Nick is going to be so proud.
Fresh in my mind, the height.
Nick's going to hear this and be like, you know what? Those guys know what they're doing. So, we're going to continue our segment where we go over top 100 prospects. We're going to start at 90. We're going to go 90 to 100. But when I say 90, it kind of is a volatile 90 because people have graduated before we've gotten through all of them. The list is a little different. So I'm going to start roughly at around 85, I think, just to glance through to see if there's anybody we haven't talked about and should talk about. But we are going to finish up this segment today and have to figure out a new way to fill the last 20 minutes of every podcast. And we're glad to do it. But just so you know, we're going to start in like the mid 80s. We should be starting at 90, but with all the updates, I just want to make sure we don't miss anybody who might have, snuck in because of some graduations. So,
yeah.
Actually, 84 is Max Meyer. We've talked quite a bit about him, just up and down. I'm surprised he's still down, to be honest with you, because there have been some injuries there or some changes being made there.
I agree.
Just weird that Max Meyer is still down. There's got to be something else we don't know about. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm just speculating, but it seems odd because he was their best pitcher when they sent him down and, you know.
Yeah, even actually him being this low on the list, I'm surprised.
Yeah, like, it happened recently because I was just filling out the expected starting pitching. By the way, check out the expected starting pitching schedules on Pitcher List. That is authored by Trevor Huth, who I hear is somebody who writes at Pitcher List. I'm kidding. That's me. I do that. But I was looking
weekly?
It up.
Trevor, you do that week.
It is weekly. Yes. It comes out on Mondays.
Okay.
But I was just right. Edward Cabrera goes to the IL and Sixto Sanchez was filling in the spot last I saw. Why not Max Meyer?
Oh, Sixto Sanchez. I forgot about him.
Yeah. Why not Max Meyer? Anyway, that's a whole diatribe for a whole different podcast. 85 is Lazaro Montes, who if you're in dynasty leagues, invest heavily in. Big fan. He's been shooting up the prospect lists and shooting up the hype lists. Gabriel Gonzalez in high A. He plays for the Twins. He's an outfielder, infielder. Braden Taylor, high A for the Tampa Bay Rays. At 88, I don't believe we've talked about him. He's in Triple A right now, and that is Thomas Seguis.
Yeah, I don't believe
with so. With the Cardinals. So do you have any thoughts there? He came over. He was with the Rangers, and then he came over in the same trade that brought over Tekoa Roby. It brought over... Oh, major league reliever. Can't think of his name, but I believe that was the Jordan Montgomery trade.
Oh, yeah. Last year's All-Star break.
And Seguis went absolutely off following the trade. Might be the second best prospect they got in the trade behind Tekoa Roby, but that's a conversation for a different time. Thomas Seguis went off. Do you know much about him?
I don't. Well, what's interesting here is he's just listed as infielder. Like there's not a specific position, and I'm reading through his profile here, and it says that he profiles the best at second, but Nolan Gorman, of course, on the Cardinals, and Brendan Donovan ahead of him on the depth chart. So it says the Rangers and Cardinals moved him around with time at second base, third, even short. So could be a positional battle, kind of like we've talked about a few different times with the Orioles and other teams. Where is he going to fit in? But looking at this list as we continue, this might maybe one of the only other guys who gets to the majors this year from this bottom of the list.
Yeah. So one of the issues with Seguis in terms of positionality, as you were talking about, is that I believe he's a hit over field player. That's hard to actually verify because it's hard to scout fielding when you're only seeing video. But almost every place that has scouting grades has him the same way where he's hit over field. So I guess that's kind of where my idea of it came from. Mm-hmm. I don't want to steal credit from other places who have been able to see him and put in work. But if he's hit over field, that means it's a bat driven profile and he's going to need to hit. Personally, I think it's hit over power. So his hit tool is going to carry him. I don't think that means the power is bad necessarily, but the question is, it's the same as always. What do you do with him? Because right now you're paying Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado a ton of money to be your corner infielders. You have, as you mentioned, Nolan Gorman. You have Mason Wynn. You have Tommy Edman. You have Brendan Donovan. The Cardinals brought in some talent on the infield with that trade, but this is a classic Cardinals thing where they're going to have a logjam for certain positions and they might wind up trading someone off who becomes really good. We've seen it in the past. I mean, I don't want to just bring up the outfielders all the time, right? Because it's so easy to pull up Randy Rosarena and Adolis Garcia and, Lane Thomas even. I always think of Luke Voit. I know that's wrong because he was probably the least successful of everybody I just named, but I always think of Luke Voit because they wound up trading him away and they did get Giovanni Gallegos in that trade with the Yankees, but
yep.
He was stuck because he could only play first base. There was no room for him and they sent him off and he had a good few years there. And I think they might have to do that again with Luke and Baker.
He did all right.
And Luke and Baker might follow the same path. Who knows? Because Luke and Baker can only play first base. Sagis might be the same play. It's just, what do you do with them other than let them either rot in AAA or trade them away and try to get value, and then they turn out to be really good?
Yeah, I mean, that's hurts as an organization when it keeps happening, but there's only so many people you can carry on your roster. And as far as fantasy purposes, I don't know. He might be someone who hits with for a high average or might help you with like on base percentage, but I don't know if he brings the power. Doesn't seem like it, maybe. And it says he has power for 15 plus home runs projection and he doesn't wow with speed. So I don't think, a lot of infielders, sometimes you're looking with, maybe they're not very powerful or they're slick fielders, but they are fast and so they can get stolen bases. Doesn't sound like maybe he's a stolen base guy. So yeah, what I'm trying to say is there may be limited fantasy value.
There might be, and especially one thing that gets pointed out in his most recent scouting report on Baseball America, again, want to shout them out, love their work, is that he has an aggressive approach. And so if you are contact driven with an aggressive approach, you can get into a lot of trouble, especially if you have good contact skills. It sounds counterintuitive. But there are times when, again, this is just my evaluation, my opinion, but there are times when you can watch a guy who has a really good hit tool and can cover the zone really well with his bat. It seems like it can hurt them. They'll swing at a bad pitch because they have an aggressive approach and they can hit it because they have this great contact skill, but it doesn't turn out to be a good hit. They can't get a barrel on it. And so that can cause some problems sometimes. I'm not saying it will with Sagis, but when I see those guys with aggressive approaches and good hit tools, that's one thing that I worry about. That's one thing I certainly look for when I'm going through trying to scout him.
Mm-hmm.
So that is Thomas Sagis. He was at 88. 89 is Roderick Arias. I believe we had mentioned him before. Thomas White at 90. Yohandy Morales, Yo-Yo Morales with the Nationals. I like him a lot. Again, he's more of a dynasty format kind of guy, but I'm a fan there. There is a pair of Rockies at 92 and 93 in this update. Both of them in Double A. Both of them with an ETA of 2024. Sterling Thompson is at 92. Zach Veen is at 93. Nate, do you have any particular thoughts about either one of those players?
Zach Veen is someone I was watching in my dynasty league. I think he was traded a couple times. This is someone he does have some speed. And he's intriguing to me, I guess. Just in my short thoughts on him. We haven't talked about him, I don't think, right?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. It's someone I kind of had on my radar, Rockies, right? That always gives a little boost, I guess. But, I remember him from my dynasty league thinking about trading for him. But other than that, I don't know a ton about him.
Yeah, I know more about him than I do Thompson. Veen was kind of in that first class when I was really getting like into prospects and into the draft. He was in that first class, and he was, either the best or one of the best high school hitters in that draft, or at least touted at time of the draft. I mean, he can have some silly power at times, which is good because he's going to play in Coors as a home park. At least that's what it looks like right now. But I think some of that power projection has faded off since the draft. And I've watched games where he's done stuff where he has silly power. Like there was one where it almost looked like he accidentally hit a home run to the opposite field. Like he was trying to foul it off and it just turned out to go about 350 feet the other way or whatever, and there's certain stuff like that. But for the most part, I think he fell off because he had a bad year last year. I don't, one bad year does not ruin a prospect in my eyes. So I wouldn't fade him too hard for that necessarily. You have to fade him a little bit, but a decent hitter, decent power, I think is what you're projecting out as. I don't think he's going to be the superstar kind of hitter that was thought of coming out of high school, but that's, part of the risk. So playing in Coors is going to help him. And I think that will help his case if he does make the majors and if he this year and if he should be on your radar. 94 is Moises Ballesteros with the Cubs. He's in Double A, but not projected to to make it to the majors until 2026, according to MLB Pipeline. Mm-hmm. Cam Collier, the youngest man from his draft, is in High A right now, still only 19 years old. Jackson Churio's brother Jason at 96. He's an outfielder in the Guardian system. He is in A ball right now. Edgar Cuero, I think, is interesting enough to have a conversation about in terms of what we're looking for in Coffee Talk. They project him to be 2025. He's 21 years old. He's a catcher, but it's the White Sox. And so I am a fan of Cuero.
A catcher, which we had a few episodes ago, had a good conversation about catchers in fantasy. And so it's hard to find them.
It is. And there's, part of the problem is that he is a catcher, right? I like what Cuero brings. He's projected 2025. So I don't know if he necessarily has to be on your radar. But he was, even when he was in the lower minors, he was a guy whose bat I loved. He was with the Angels at the time. I get confused because the Brewers have Jefferson Cuero as a catcher. And then the Angels traded Edgar Cuero to the White Sox, who is also a catcher. So I'm just trying to keep those straight on who was playing for what team. But yes, so Edgar Cuero came from the Angels. And, it's a guy who's hit over power. So he's going to have less power than Veen. I don't know he's going to help you too much in the power department, but he could have, a slightly above average hit tool. And from the catcher position, that can be super helpful because, catchers are always, there's a few at the top and then you might as well just wait till the last round if you don't get one of them. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So it's almost like if you could find a catcher who, even if he doesn't help you, doesn't hurt you, mm-hmm. is even a benefit.
Right. Right. And especially if you play in a two catcher league, catchers become so much more important. It might be worth monitoring him, especially in those kind of leagues where if he does get called up, you might just want to give it a shot. Cause I keep saying this in the expected starting pitching article too. There's got to be a point in this White Sox season where they let the young kids play.
Mm-hmm.
They're already way behind in the NL Central race, right? At some point they have to be like, okay, well, I guess the current players we have aren't working. Let's just try the young guys, get them experience, and maybe we can come back next year and have guys who have already gotten their major league experience. We're going to be young and experienced enough to where we might be able to win something and make some noise, at least in the AL Central.
It seems like why not, at some point.
And that could be why we see Cuero. But again, who knows what's going to happen there. Jefferson Rojas coming in at 98. He is a shortstop in the Cubs system. He is in high A. I'm just going to skip over 99 for a minute. 100 is Ralphie Velasquez in the Guardian system. Again, A ball, 18 years old, 99 coming back to it. It's a guy we've talked about a couple times already. And that is
Victor Scott.
Oh, man. I don't think we need to say too much, but just circle around and check in, I guess, Nate. How are you feeling about Victor Scott?
Well, that was surprising to see his name at 99 because as he already debuted and was kind of a surprise debut, then he really struggled. And I remember last we talked about him, I think you were saying he had struggled once he went back to the minors. But still, the speaking of speed, the killer speed, if he could ever put it together and be an okay hitter, he'd be very interesting from a fantasy perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he got sent down and in April hit 179, and so far in May he's hitting 229. So it's not like he's setting the world on fire, but it looks like things are starting to click for him a little bit. He's starting to figure things out. And I think him being at 99 is a testament to some of the things that you need to put a prospect list together, because it's there's a reason that everybody has a different prospect list, right? And it's because you value different things. You might, and you evaluate players different for sure, but you know, like the top guys, what do you value when you're making a list, right? Because when you get in the top five players, top 10 players, there's not a whole lot of argument of who's in there usually, right? There's generally agreed upon. There might be some people who have these wild hot takes that may or may not wind up being true, whatever, but there's certain things you look at. And I think what is helping Victor Scott with his prospect standing and where he is on the list is proximity. And that's one of the things that you can look at. How close are you to the majors? And again, different lists and different people will value that differently because there's ceiling, there's floor, there's risk, there's proximity there, you know, there's all this stuff. And I think what, right now, especially with his performances, what Victor Scott has going for him is the fact that he has made it. He's on a 40-man roster, and he's not far away if they need to call someone.
Yeah, he's probably the first call or second call that Cardinals make if someone gets hurt, right? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
I'm sure he'll be back this year.
Yeah, they're definitely – I mean, it wasn't a one-and-done thing. If he was, then he's the ultimate coffee talk poster child, I guess. Yeah. And I hope that's not the case, and I very much doubt that will be the case. He should get another chance, but again, he's got to figure it out, right? He might not get a chance till next year if he doesn't start, you know, picking up his performances at the plate in AAA. With that being said, we had a great episode of Coffee Talk today. Once again, I just want to thank Pat Vendetti for coming on with us. That was a really cool thing that he did for us. That was a really cool conversation. Switch pitching is such an interesting thing, and it's an art form, if you couldn't tell by what he said. So thank you, Pat, very much for coming on. For Nate Kosher, make sure to follow him at Nathaniel Kosher on Twitter. You can follow me at Huth Trevor on Twitter. And of course, you can follow our podcast at Coffee Talk PL on Twitter. And make sure to just keep listening to these episodes. Tell your friends. Say, hey, I got like the best podcast ever, probably. Make sure to listen to it. But Nate, thank you so much. Thank you again to Pat. And we will have another episode of Coffee Talk in a week. If you can wait that long, you're going to have to anyway. At Coffee Talk, we are always ready for that next cup of coffee. Coffee Talk is a part of the Pitcherlist Podcast Network.